Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast. My name is Dino Ray Ramos, and Happy New Year! Welcome to the first episode of 2020, and this week we have our first guest of the new decade, Aldis Hodge, who is the star of Clemency, opposite Alfre Woodard, a wonderful, gripping drama about prison reform, the death row penalty. Aldis was a wonderful guest. He broke a lot of things down for us. He unpacked a lot of things about his career and what he's been through, and just kind of his journey is just so interesting, so it was great hearing that. Most importantly, we talk about his role as Voodoo in Friday Night Lights. As many of y'all may know, I am from Texas. Amanda's from Texas. I am very obsessed with Friday Night Lights, so we spend a good portion of time talking about that. And we also talk about Clemency, which everyone should go watch when you get the chance. So without further ado, here is Mr. Aldis Hodge.
Aldis, thank you again for joining us. For this podcast, you kind of like to start at the beginning of like people's journeys in the business.
When you were born.
When you were born.
Once I was a child.
You're from North Carolina? Or is that where you grew up?
I was born in North Carolina.
Okay.
Both of my parents were Marines at the time.
Oh, military family. My dad was in the Air Force.
Oh, word up?
Yeah.
Which base were you born on?
I wasn't born on a base. Surprise. Oh, no, I was actually. Duh. Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio.
Word up. I was born in Camp Lejeune. Oh,
okay.
Oh,
wow. Okay.
Cool. Yeah. So did you guys move? You guys moved around a lot?
Yeah. Okay. Basically, right after I was born, we were shipped to Kaneohe on Oahu in Hawaii.
Oh, wow.
So there for about a year and a half, me and my brother caused a little trouble. But
nice.
Yeah. We were babies at the time, trying to be crazy. We were living on the water at one point, and we, for some reason, one morning picked up everything we could possibly carry and threw it into the ocean.
Wow.
Wait, why?
why would you do that?
You had to ask. I don't know. Right. Yes. I blame.
He's like, what? How were you?
I blame Ed. that's like, my older brother, Edwin. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I think I've met your brother, actually.
Oh, right.
I think a while ago.
Okay.
At a Deadline event.
Like, okay.
I think he came to like one of our parties one time. But anyways, back to our regularly scheduled program. But when did you first get bitten by the acting bug?
Well, my brother used to always say he wanted to be in the box, which was the TV. So he started first at 3. Mm. And then I followed suit at 2, trying to be like him and just trying to figure out how to get money to buy Batman toys.
Nice.
So I was 2 when I started. My brother and I, we came up through the ranks, like Sesame Street for like 2 years. Mm. We did a Broadway play for two and a half years.
You were on Sesame Street?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Oh, wait, yeah. Who did you interact with?
So there was a group of us, man. We were all these little group of kids. This is back in, I was probably like 6, so you're talking early 90s. Mm-hmm. And they just had like a set group of kids, a core group that they had for whatever segment, whether it's counting or talking ABCs or whatever. Oh. You know, the New Year's episodes were always the biggest episodes. Mm-hmm. I remember that. But yeah, I mostly kicked it with like Big Bird and Elmo. Those are the homies.
Those are like the two icons.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You were in good company.
By the way, shout out to respect to Carol Spinney.
That's
a big one right there. But so we just kind of came up through the ranks. I remember we did Die Hard with a Vengeance, and I was playing Sam Jackson's nephew at the time. Didn't know who he or Bruce Willis was because I was eight. I was to watch their films. Yeah. But Sam told my mom, if your kids really want to learn the craft of acting, they got to get on stage. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, right after that film wrapped, we had an audition for Showboat, which was my mom thought was just like a commercial. Mm-hmm. And when my brother booked it, she thought it was like the longest commercial contract ever because they were like, yo, 6 months. Commercial was 6 months.
Per commercial.
And then we realized it was a play, of course. So he did it for the first year. I came in after that, and we both finished out the rest of the year and a half of the tour on Broadway.
Nice.
So, yeah, he did a full 2.5. But it was great training.
Yeah.
I say for me, it was my mom always made us earn it because having a childhood was priority. Having education was paramount, and that took over. So if we were not getting A's and B's in school, we were not able to audition or pursue. Mm-hmm. If we wanted to pursue acting, we had to really earn it, treat it like anything, sports or whatever, instruments. Mm-hmm. Yo, you're going to do your best at this, you know. But she prioritized us having a childhood over everything and understanding where our mind was when it came to this. But when I was 12 years old, I was on a TV show. We did the pilot, and they tested the pilot, and because myself along with two other cast members on that pilot tested higher in popularity than the lead on the show, they fired us instead of, you know.
Oh, instead of giving you guys, oh my God.
Yeah, oh, like how do you get fired for doing your job too well?
Wait, so can I ask though, like who, the lead, was it a white person?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That tracks.
It tracks well. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Golly,
So when I was 12 years old and that happened, and I didn't understand.
Right,
it didn't make
right.
any logical sense to me because I was always, you know, a heady sort of booky kid. And for me, it just had to add up. Mm-hmm, you know, I was very analytical, and it just doesn't add up to do a job so well that, you know, oh, the audience loves it. The show gets picked up, but you got to go because you're doing too good.
Wow.
The fuck? Like, really?
That's crazy.
So that's when, for me, I was like, all right, I'm choosing this because I don't like feeling expendable or disposable, like somebody's quick little contraband. I'm in and out, you know. So I'd always taken myself seriously, but I had to start taking the business. I had to reassess my relationship with the business at that age, and started writing and really started trying to figure out who I was in the game.
That's cool that you had your brother.
Y'all came up together.
Yeah, we did. I mean, we did everything together. Like I said, Sesame Street was probably the first big thing that we did together, and that's back when we were like, five and six or something like that. You know, before that, it was like Extra Work and print. Like, we were both extras on the set of Malcolm X.
Oh, wait, no way.
Yeah.
Really? Did you guys meet John David?
Nah.
Oh, okay.
Like,
he was on there too.
He was
in Malcolm X. Yeah,
yeah.
That's really cool.
Shout out to Tenet trailer that came out.
Yeah. And he's a friend of the podcast.
He's been on the podcast before.
Oh, really? That's dope. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I've never met him.
Well, you guys have that in common.
But yeah, we did a lot of things together back in the day, and we haven't worked together on the same set in a minute. We still aim to develop things together. I would love to get back to being on set. Right now, we're trying to find something to do together just because it's just right.
So, you know, you've had this storied career. You know, how have the roles that you've picked until Clemency sculpted the kind of actor you wanted to be?
I realized in my teenage years, I had to start being I had to start invoking my power of choice, because up to that point, it's like, you just do what you can do until you can do what you want to do.
Right,
you know, basically,
exactly.
You know, I just got to get the job.
Exactly.
So around about like 14, I started noticing everything that was getting thrown my way was thug this, thug that, gangster, athlete. And again, I was very much an academic. I studied the history of academia as it was passed down through Black culture. Mm. So I was also an artist. I started college at 14. And to me, that's...
Okay, prodigy.
but check this out.
Right.
But check this out, though. Check this out. I mean, again, that's shout to moms for prioritizing.
No, that's like dope that your mom was like, oh, you're going to get your shit together first before you go
back.
Well,
the thing is, you know, our lane out of poverty was education. Mm-hmm. That was our direct conduit to anything that we wanted to do. She said that they can take anything away from you in this world except for what you know.
Oh, nice.
And we'd have been through some things. You know, life was not easy. So for us... it was always education, and the fact that I was, you know, a young Black kid growing up between primarily Jersey and New York in my childhood, most people didn't assume to attach intellect to me because of my skin.
Right.
It just pissed me off.
Right.
Because I'm like, yo, we are naturally, as a culture, this is what we do. This is normal. So, yes, you know, it might be a little bit different that I'm in college at 14, but at the same time, I saw so many kids like me in that lane, and I'm like, yo, this needs to be exposed because this is to a degree of normalcy for us, you know, and other Black kids need to know and see that this is our potential. This is the peak. You know, this is regular for you, so step up. But beyond that, the rest of the world, especially in America, needs to start acknowledging and giving due credit to us as a culture, because right now there's so much degradation tied to the perspective or the perception of who and what we are.
Exactly.
You know, so for me, again, when I was 14 and I start seeing all this, I'm like, this is not who we are. Like, there's so much more. This is cool. You know, there's nothing wrong with it to play a thug or whatever, but there's so much more to that. And I'm also going on auditions where literally in one audition, there was a, I remember sitting there in this, you know, white casting director, I don't know, man in his 40s sitting there telling me, well, you're not Black enough for the role.
I've been told that before.
And that's because...
I think every person of color or even just marginalized person has been told that
and I'm
at
like,
one point in their
what
life.
What would you know? Obviously, you know nothing about Black people because of the fact that I am Black and I'm representing what exactly my truth is.
Exactly.
And because I'm not ignorant or dumber than you expected,
then
I'm not Black. Yeah. That's what it is. So I go up against that on a regular basis in this industry still to this day.
I was going to ask you if it's still something that you have to deal
to
with.
To this day.
Wow.
Which is just so crazy. And I think it's just so crazy, you know, we see the same story. It's like an it's a generational thing too. It's like you said you were going out for like thugs, for athletes, and that's been since what, like, since films even started, I guess.
Right.
And, and again, there's nothing wrong with that
long
as there's a point to
exactly.
the role. If it's simply to degrade or to pacify the idea
of
who and what we are, I'm not with it. But if there's an actual real purpose to it, let's do it. You know what I'm saying? But I had to start saying no. I had to start sacrificing roles. And this is talking about not working for like 8 months at a time, not making money, trying to figure out where the bills are going, you know, where we going to get that money from.
Yeah.
And I say this for the actors listening and for anybody actually listening, you have to sacrifice for your value. You have to
have to
understand where your potential is, and you have to be willing to be patient enough and to struggle and to sacrifice for it so that at the end of the day, when you do get it, you can enjoy it. It's not tainted
with
the idea of selling your soul just to get by. So that's when, you know, after a little while, certain roles started to become earned, certain opportunities started to become earned that were closer to me walking in my purpose with my craft.
Yeah,
I like that. Sacrifice for your value.
And it's so hard for people, especially in this business, because this business is so, like, you never know, you know. And I always like, it's always, you never know. You see people like especially your friends hit and you haven't hit yet, and you kind of like, I know a lot of people, like, especially young people, you start panicking, and then.
It's a lack of faith in themselves because there's a lack of foresight.
Right. That's
right?
what it is.
And it's hard to get that foresight when you don't see it continuously as a blueprint.
Mm.
You know, we're made to oftentimes see things, see successes as this this ethereal thing that just happens to a select few because people get left. But most people don't understand. Those who are truly successful, and I'm not talking about monetarily, I'm not talking about just financially, successful in themselves, and whatever comes with that comes.
Mm-hmm.
Those who are truly successful have been working at it for a very long time. 5 minutes of fame takes 15 years to get to.
Mm-hmm.
And the real work is in making sure that there's consistency. Mm-hmm. You know, when you get to a certain level, can you get beyond that level? Can you keep that consistent? Can you fight at that level and compete at that level with the same tenaciousness and ferocity that it took you to even start, right? Mm-hmm. But I love when I think Ashton Kutcher said it at this award show one time. He said, "Real work looks." He said, "Success looks like hard work." Right. Yeah. I'm paraphrasing, but and it's true.
Yeah,
you know, I've been in the game 31 years. Cats are looking at me like, "Wow, man, look at this new fresh face." I don't want to curse on here, right. But
no, you can curse. You can curse on here.
Ain't shit fresh about me, okay? I am 33, but I ain't no spring chicken. And the reason that I always profess my admiration for what the journey has been is because mm-hmm. there are so many other actors out there right now who are hustling and struggling. They've been in the game for years and like, dang, when is it gonna come? And I'm just saying, yo, I've been here, I've been there. Just keep going.
Right,
you
right.
gotta keep going. You don't have a choice. If you know what you're supposed to be doing, you know what your passion is calling you to, you have to keep going.
Yeah, so, you know, I personally remember you from Friday Night Lights. We were talking about this before. And
that's because of that Texas love.
Yes.
And also, I came, that scene, like that high school football
scene. That was
our school.
That was our school.
It's like a that portrayal of what it is. And I remember, I always say this, our school beat the school that Friday Night Lights was based on.
Oh, yeah.
For state, Odessa, right?
Oh, we got some rivalry up ahead.
we beat them for state. I think we beat them 2 years
look
in a row.
You.
Anyways.
Let them know.
Justin Rocket. No, but so like, I remember you from Friday Night Lights, and I remember as soon as you got on the scene, I was like, oh my God, I'm scared of this guy. And you were doing your job well. Challenged Coach Taylor. That was kind of like my first memory, but how did that change? Did Friday Night Lights kind of change it? Because it was a prestige show at the time.
Yeah.
How did that change your career?
I remember that first year was a little tough for us to find the audience. I feel like there was a lot of scrutiny going against the show because people were like, well, who wants to watch a show about football? Da, da, da. Unless people actually understood and loved football. Mm-hmm. But once they saw how driven and how developed the actual characters were and the drama was just so succinct, then it kind of came in where we found our success, I think, a little bit later after the first season. Mm-hmm. But once people saw it, it was like, wow, this is actually really well done, mm-hmm. well-scripted drama, right?
Yeah.
With Friday Night Lights, I remember walking into that audition. My mom hustled up that audition. I ain't even had that, but she was like, look, I found something go through because moms was always on the hustle. Mm-hmm. And I had just gotten fired from a job previously, and I was pissed. Mm-hmm. So when I went into that audition, I really was.
Oh, you were voodoo.
I was like, oh, word?
So they were like, oh, this guy's good.
he's so authentic. You damn Skippy. It's lost. I ain't got no car. I was just coming from I had a car accident earlier that year.
Oh,
it was total.
God.
Oh, my God. You a journey.
Oh, brother, that's light work. That's light work, bro. If I told the journey, you know, I'd tell you. But I had gotten fired from, yet again, another TV series that I didn't understand at the time because they were merging into a network, and there was a lot of chefs in the kitchen. And we had gotten picked up, and they said, oh, we got to let you go. And I said, well, we got picked up. What's the deal? Some of the executives think you're more of a dramatic actor. It was, but here's the thing, though. Here's the thing. So I was 19 at the time. Uh-huh. This was a comedy. I was the only member of the cast who was actually a stand-up comedian at the time.
Mm. Oh, you did stand-up too?
Bro, I started stand-up at 11 years old, I started stand-up. Oh, at 13 years old, I started hosting a room at the LA Improv. We would put on shows, and I ran that to I was 17, 18. So I'm like, yo,
this is my
I'm up here improv, and I'm doing my thing. I know how to work a stage. How y'all gonna say I'm dramatic? Like, so either way, I was so pissed about that because at the time, had a house with the family. That was my only means of taking care of the fam. Mm. Had a car that I'd gotten total, got into an accident. Thank God I was okay, but still my car was out. Mm-hmm. Couldn't afford another one. And then had a, I was in a bad relationship at the time that was stressing me out, jeez, causing some issues. So it was just a lot all on you at one time. Yeah. And again, I look back and I'm like, okay, that's light work. Because right. I've been through worse. Mm-hmm. My whole family been through worse. But in the moments, you can't see through all that. Right. And what I realized is that happened, and then Friday Night Lights happened. And I said, oh, that was God moving something out of my way so the right thing can line right. up and I can walk straight to it.
Yeah.
And that's how you got to look at the idea of lack or loss, because when things are presumably taken from us, right, nothing's guaranteed, nothing's given, right? But mm-hmm. when something is removed out of our way, some of us just spend the time focusing on the negative and the idea of loss as opposed to focusing on the opportunity that is now presented in front of us. Mm-hmm. And you got to just make sure that that's where your focus goes. You got to look mm-hmm. towards it. You got to actively seek it, because there's always an open door somewhere, mm-hmm. right?
Right?
So then when Friday hit, and crazy enough, the comedy was a football show, but Friday mm-hmm. was a football show to drama.
Drama, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It definitely gave me, I think, more respect on that short stint of a recurring mm-hmm. than being on that comedy show ever would have for me. Well, shade to the comedy.
No, right. You left a big, like I said, when you came on Friday Night Lights, I was like, because really,
I mean, your character is still very memorable.
Yeah,
even though it was
some
a recurring character.
Some people still
character.
Call me Voodoo.
And like
low key, I'm like, it's weird when people call me my character names from things, because I don't even know who they're talking to.
They're like a Voodoo, and you're like,
I'm like, what? I don't walk around thinking, oh, I'm an actor. People must know who I am. I'm still like, I got that Jersey, New York mentality. Like, yo, you looking over there kind of funny. What's up? Like, I need you to say something. Right. Don't be in the corner just looking at me funny style. You know, and I'm waiting for you, hey, bro. You feeling froggy,
you,
leap.
Everyone's looking at you like, oh, is that Voodoo?
Yeah, but that's the thing.
But it's like, you can't just be staring at somebody
so
like
here's
that
the thing.
Without
this is a little detour, but sometimes I really do appreciate the love from people who support my work.
Yeah.
But There's some people don't realize the strange human interaction, like when they look at you from across the way and they get this look on their face because they're trying to
figure out
how they know you.
They scrunch their
eyebrows. But
there's a
frown and what it looks like, and then they start talking to their homie about
they're like this.
What they don't realize is they look like they're actually talking about you, like
they're
trying
to square up.
And it's like depending on where you're from.
Where you're from.
It's different ways of interpreting it.
No,
right?
yeah. Because like when people do that like at an industry party, I'm
yeah,
just
you're
like,
kind of like, oh, they probably know who you are.
Yeah.
They're like you.
But
right,
if it's
like,
just like in a restaurant or at like the mall or something.
At the mall, you know? I grew up between Jersey and New York. Back in the day,
Jersey,
when somebody was a word up. Oh, you sound good. Nah, I was in Trenton and then Hackensack and then Clifton, you know? So neither place was exactly too easy. Mm-hmm. But I grew up in a time where cats would just look at you funny. You knew you was about to square up.
Yeah.
So the thing is, it doesn't leave you. I've never squared up on nobody
that
came. You know, I love when fans go, hey, how you doing? I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm getting it. You know what I mean? But it's just weird sometimes.
So here, there's a lesson. If you see Aldis, don't go up to them and be like, hey, do I know you from somewhere?
You know, I just smile.
Yeah.
Right,
that's all I'm asking.
You know,
you know, it's so
just
simple.
Smile.
If you smile, then it's like, okay,
it's more inviting.
You know, and then also, you know, say something.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Don't be nervous.
You can say something, you know. I ain't gonna swing on.
Lesson learned.
You know.
So I want to talk about your two recent projects, Brian Banks and
Clemency. Yeah.
Very, very heavy.
Yes.
Projects, to say the least.
Not comedies.
Not like,
what are you talking about?
They're not.
Whatever do you mean?
I mean,
I must be watching it.
One is about somebody who's wrongfully in prison, and one is one is about somebody who's on death row.
Yeah.
Wait, did you film these back to back?
Yeah. Like, how did you recover?
Right, exactly.
Sort of, kind of, maybe. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, God.
Okay.
Yeah. So I filmed the Banks first, and then knocked out the season of City on a Hill. I did Banks, then City on a Hill. We did the pilot, and then after that, did Clemency. So, you know, back to back, I had these three projects that were all about criminal justice reform and reform within the legal system. Yeah. Right, so I was all right, universe, what you trying to tell me? Right. It's not like I was actively seeking, like, hey, team, you know what we need to do?
I need a trilogy of criminal justice reform.
But the thing I loved about Brian Banks is if you've ever met Brian in real life, which I think you should, he's a dope, dope cat, life coach now. To me, that was the idea of a real superhero, somebody who persevered, because, you know, the brother went into, he was, what, 16, I think, when he was accused. He spent a year fighting the case while still imprisoned. I think he was in a juvie or jail, one of the two, but then, like, 18th birthday, went off to prison, five years. And then when he got out of prison, he was on parole, 5 years, with an ankle monitor the whole time. So he basically was still in prison on the outside. He educated himself while in prison, studied the law, fought for himself, he exonerated himself. That, to me, perseverance over all, that mindset was so inspirational. And he himself, to have come out of that and survived with such an appetite for positivity and to not allow the negativity to shape him, that, to me, was a part of why we do what we do as artists, because we got to, you know, we love to give people entertainment, laugh, and this and that, but also at the same time, spread some hope. And because it spoke to me personally, I was hoping to have that very same conversation with the audience through my work. Clemency, still to a degree in the same vein, it opened my eyes to the idea of capital punishment, which I hope this film can be an asset to the conversation of how to get to a point of eradicating this disease we know to be the death row sentence. I love that it does show the true effects for everybody involved, not just surface level. And it shows the effects on the prison warden, played brilliantly by Alfre Woodard, Queen Alfre Woodard. We have Wendell Pierce playing her husband. We see how that, you know, hits their marriage. We have Richard Schiff playing my lawyer. We see how it hits him. We have Danielle Brooks, who plays, I don't want to spoil it. She plays someone important in my character's life, and she smashes, you know, absolutely smashes her role. So, you know, we have a beautifully well-rounded cast, Michael C. Neal, you know, Alex Steele. Like, everybody came through with their hearts on fire. And, you know, it's a strange thing, because people are like, well, really? Wow, you know, it's this kind of movie? I'm like, look, right now, we're having a real conversation about real lives. We went to these prisons. We talked to these men. We did the research. We know the power, rather the responsibility that we have as artists to inspire and to hopefully help and aid those in need. And when it comes to this particular situation, that's exactly what this film could do. That's exactly why I took this film.
It's crazy to think, because we watched Just Mercy. And, like, just, you know, obviously, Jamie Foxx's character, it's Walter, I can't remember his last name, but it's, you know, obviously he was released and everything, but it's crazy to think that how many people are on death row, because your character wasn't, I mean, I don't think he wasn't able to get his, it's crazy to think how many people are on death row that are innocent and are not able to get, like, their due time in court because of all these different
technical. Because of resources.
Resources is the main thing. So here's the question that I asked myself upon dealing with this particular role is, do we as a society have the right to take the lives of those who presumably have taken life? If so, does that not make us just like them?
That is exactly what I was thinking when I was watching it. That is exactly what I was thinking. I was like, how are you just
going to...
How do you justify that in your head? Like, that's, you know, because this person killed this
person.
Because
people don't. They just don't even think about it that way.
Because the thing is, there are plenty of people who are on death row that are absolutely innocent. And this is another reason why we need to continue to dig deeper and understand every facet of what the situation is, so as not to make another... I'll call it civil mistake that's a stain on us all, right? Then for the men that are guilty, regardless of what they've done, regardless of what our judgment and our stances are, what they may be, some of what this film explores is, like with my character, as he's fighting for clemency, we don't know if he did or did not do the crime, because that's not the point.
Right.
The point
is right.
Okay. If he did it, then sure, great. Yeah. If he didn't do it, well, I guess we're making a mistake.
Yeah.
No.
Exactly.
The point is, us as a society, how are we pacified by the idea of death as it is wrapped in the lie of justice, mm-hmm. When we're not even given all the facts? Mm. And does it not poison how we deal with one another to a degree of trying to be humane? Mm-hmm, what does that really look like, right? When we can say, well, you know, you deserve to die, so X, Y, and Z, da, da, da. No. Mm-hmm. No, we don't have that right. Mm-hmm. And we should not get comfortable with the idea that that's okay.
Right.
So, you know, our filmmaker, our brilliant writer and director, Shinoya Chukwu, she spent years researching, I think 4 or 5 years researching this before it even came to shooting it. She volunteered in a prison in Ohio. She started a screenwriting program called Pens to Pictures for inmates to get their projects written and put on screen. She volunteered on 14 different clemency cases. She is the real deal.
Yeah,
she was a film professor for 10 years.
Yeah.
And for her, she was inspired to explore the causality behind all of this after the execution of Troy Davis, black man in Georgia, mm-hmm. in September 2011. Prior to his execution, there are hundreds of thousands of letters written in support of his clemency, even prison wardens who are writing about the effects of execution on the part of everyone.
Right.
You know, there are people who work in this particular department, prison wardens, guards, who have a PTSD rate that is comparable to those coming back from war.
Yeah.
So there's a bigger problem that continues to get elaborated upon dealing with this particular situation. So, you know, after he was executed, she began to ask the question, I wonder what it's like for those whose livelihood is tied to the taking of life.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to explore that, and that's what she did with this film.
Mm.
And I'm paraphrasing from her own words.
Yeah, but how were you able to sort of get in that mindset? Because there's this one line in the movie that really gets me, and I don't think it's a spoiler, but he says, I don't know if I'm saying it
right. Well, you spoil everything.
He said something about how I don't want you to, you can't tell me how, like, to take my life, or you can't. I'm
I know
which
line
you're talking about. I just can't remember exactly the word, but something. But you know what I'm talking about. I choose when I die. That scene, like, it was so hard to watch.
So I'm gonna set that up.
But I just want to know, like, how do you get in that? And then obviously you met with a bunch of people.
Yeah,
on
yeah.
The tour. Like, how do you?
So oddly enough, when I went to San Quentin, I was given a tour of the facility by men serving life sentences. I was not permitted to speak to the men on death row as per the warden's restrictions, but did talk to the warden as well. You know what? Really great, respectable guy.
Mm-hmm.
Showed us the death chambers. There were a few polarizing things that I witnessed while I was there. When the men on death row were transferred across the yard, all of the other inmates were made to turn their backs and not speak to them and not look at them.
Oh.
Right? So the isolation that is enforced upon these men in death row down to their presumably last steps is dehumanizing.
Mm-hmm.
We went to the death chamber and he asked us, so, you know, these men and women, they usually get a choice for how they would prefer to pass.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, you know, intravenous drugs? Is it gas chamber? Mm-hmm. What do you think they choose?
Mm-hmm.
And we said, we don't know. He said, yeah, most times they don't know, because how do you choose how you're going to die?
Yeah.
It all brings the relativity of your complicit nature as a citizen to the forefront, because mm-hmm. you're like, well, wow, this is what we spend our tax dollars on. This is what we vote on. And these are things that we don't have to think about when we go home.
Right.
But this is something we are still a part of. So maybe we should start thinking about it a little bit more vigorously. But as far as getting into the mindset, I was quite enthused and excited and happy, truly happy, because I felt like the reason I jumped onto this project was it was purpose driven, and mm-hmm. a part of what we were doing was purpose driven. First of all, Chinoya, our writer director, has a an infectious, vivacious energy. Mm-hmm. She's so great, so just happy and excitable. And that, so we're laughing on set all the time. Mm-hmm. But every time it got harder for the character to go through something, I was driven to do more and go harder, and I was actually happier because I knew that somebody's going to see this and hopefully be affected to enough to a point to want to do something to change.
Right.
So I was in a good, healthy space the entire time. Okay. There was no weight that I carried outside of the pride I had with the fact that I thought we were doing something that could serve to help.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the film won the dramatic Grand Jury Prize at Sundance.
Right. That was a shock.
Yeah. making Chinoy.
The first yeah.
Yeah.
She the was first the first black woman to receive that.
In the history.
In the history. She historical out here.
She broke ground.
She out here.
She shattered.
She told the girls. You know. She told the girls, I'm going to take my award.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have films like this, and then, you know, we had, you know, you mentioned Just Mercy, When They See Us.
Right.
These how do you think these movies, specifically Clemency, move the needle when it comes to representation and the need for storytelling that exposes harsh truths? That I think a lot of people refuse to kind of believe this kind of stuff happens, but like how else do you think this moves that needle in Hollywood, telling diverse stories, not just from like, you know, from the black community, but even within the black community, because it's not a monolith, as is like the Latino community, the Asian community. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I think I can't speak specifically to how it particularly moves the needle. Mm-hmm. All I can say is that I hope it moves the needle, because with us, you know, our stories do have the potential to spark a specific change, to get people to pay attention to certain things. With Clemency, what we're seeing is a lot of people are coming out of this film saying, wow, I didn't know it was like that. And oftentimes they say, well, what can I do? How can I help? Mm-hmm. And what can I change to do X, Y, and Z about getting involved, you know? And that's not, we're not charging or challenging our audience to do anything particular other than just hopefully they receive. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you see projects like When They See Us, and then after that we see an outpouring of support, and then that support rolls over to legal action being taken against people who abused their seats of power years before. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is what art at its peak level has the most potential to do, is inspire people to seek the truth in their true lives, and hopefully try their best to create a better quality of life going forward.
Yeah.
What do you say to people? Because I know a lot of, like, especially like films that are that happen to have black stories in it or black prominently black cast. I think we kind of do it amongst ourselves.
Don't want to say it.
A lot of our films deal with black pain, and those are the ones that get, you know, these types of recognition. Right. get wider audiences.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of black folks complain about that a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, all our movies, the movies that we are getting sort of recognition for, are about our pain. What do you think about that?
So here's the thing. I understand it. Not that I am for or against either. I understand it. It's about how the story is told.
Mm-hmm.
When the opportunity for Clemency came up, especially coming right off of Brian Banks, I was like, y'all, for real? He in jail again? Mm-hmm. Like, come on, y'all. But then I looked at the purpose behind it, the potential for what it could be. And I said, oh, this is different because, you know, we have Alfre Woodard, who comes from a huge history of activism, and she's putting her heart into this, and she had been on the project 2 years before it even got kicked off into shooting. You know, and it's not like she is making mistakes in her career. Yeah. You know? I'd like to think that she's very, very calculated about her risks.
Mm-hmm.
But speaking to her personal activism, there's something that's added to what this project is, and there's a reason behind it. Mm-hmm. Yes, a lot of our history is tied to pain. This particular movie, Clemency, it doesn't point directly to the disparity as it afflicts Black people or Black Americans or Americans who are, you know, Hispanic or, you know, but it exposes what the basics are,
mm-hmm.
and you can't help but
That's
notice,
a good point. Yeah.
You know, who's in the film.
Right.
Yeah, yeah,
you can't
right.
help but notice who's most afflicted. I think we are, as a community, tired of having to draw to the pain to see the pain, because that is primarily what we are given,
mm-hmm.
and we are seeking more to a degree of normalcy. However, there is more, and there is so much more that is out there regularly,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We do have that. We do see it.
Mm.
I think I've come to learn we do need... We need both. We need the greatness, but we also need the pain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It depends on how the pain is depicted to teach, because we need to teach others
right.
and ourselves where we come from, how we come from it, what there is to love, what there is that needs to be fixed, and what people should learn to understand about us and why we deserve in real life equanimity in so many other areas
right,
because
right.
we still don't get it. And people who are not from our culture sit there and say, well, you're just complaining. And, and it's like,
mm-hmm.
bro, you don't live in my reality.
Mm-hmm.
Let me show you something.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I remember when we did Underground, there was automatic critique about, oh, damn,
another
slave show,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're like, first of all, I ain't never been a slave show out here like this.
Yeah.
But second of all, I remember when I first heard the idea of it, and I was, to a degree, I had my reserves.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I mean, reservations. How do you do a show about enslavement for, you know, 5-6 seasons? I don't personally want to see that pain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But when I saw that, oh, this is exposing the truth of the pain, but also beyond that, exposing the truth of our valor as a people, because we are fighting for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes we're seen as being submissive,
right?
And we just have to just deal with it. And
mm-hmm,
hopefully somebody
mm-hmm.
comes and save us. Or, you know, we deal with, of course, I'm just going to say it, the white savior complex,
mm-hmm,
where
mm-hmm.
we need all this help. But who were we to get to this point?
Right.
Who were we? Where did we really come from? Where's our strength? And with Underground, we showed our people fighting for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not to knock on anybody else, any other culture. That is just saying that we get to see ourselves engaging our true strength and having the strength to laugh and love in dealing through all of the hurt.
Mm-hmm,
it teaches us so much about our values. Because we get to see it a different way, we get to experience it a different way, and off of that, I saw so many people re-engage their history with new eyes, and they
yeah.
said, yo, I love this show, I can't believe it. And now people, they start using it in schools, curriculum,
right.
all that. So
I love that show.
We just have to see different ideas of what it is.
Right,
you know?
You're right.
And we also have to see the truth on other sides
mm-hmm,
of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get to see, you know, Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and all these, you know, glorious moments,
right.
but we don't get to see their ugly truths.
Right.
Let's just be honest about
yeah.
the real history behind the so-called forefathers of America.
Right.
You know, a lot of these people were, and I will say it, to a degree, savages
mm-hmm.
in how they acted and how they carried on, but
they
don't see that truth.
No.
We need to see the equality on all sides of telling the stories.
Good point.
God, have you ever given a TED talk?
Nah, bro. But you don't, bro. That'll be a 57-hour TED talk. Let me tell you what's on my mind.
I would listen.
You have a good radio voice.
Yeah, you
too.
Do.
Yeah, yeah. This is DJ Chocolate Skittles returning live. Now listening to the tune down. Shock is good. That's terrible.
So I know. So before we wrap, what's next for you? So you have The Invisible Man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so The Invisible Man drops February 28th. I'm really excited about that.
That looks fun.
Yes.
And just so people are not confused, no, it is not Ralph Ellison.
Yeah.
It's not Ralph. It is H.G. Wells. So Lee Whannell, who wrote, I believe, the first three songs,
yeah.
and he's directed, you know, he this man lives in the horror space and he's brilliant in it. He wrote and directed this one,
mm-hmm.
Starring Elizabeth Moss, Storm
mm-hmm.
Reed. Really excited about that. Also go into shooting second season of City
mm-hmm.
on a Hill.
Yeah.
And then there's another project I'm really excited about, but I can't tell you
okay,
exactly.
Okay, well, are you sure?
I'm sure.
No,
I can't tell you. I start shooting that early next year, but
okay.
I am
right,
not at
a
liberty
Marvel
to...
Film.
I can most assuredly tell you it's not a Marvel film.
I'm all trying to
wait.
Like,
so, wait, is there anything that you haven't done yet?
Did you
would you want to do a Marvel? I mean, I guess it's like a.
If they hire me, I mean, I don't know. I've tried to hustle up an audition so many times.
Is The Invisible Man your kind of first horror? Is it a horror? More
it's
thriller.
It's sort
right?
of
it's
like, thriller, I did a horror film a long time ago, and I was like, we're just not going to talk about that. So this is my first real step into the genre, and it's actually pretty dope. Right. But, in terms of what I would like to, I grew up a martial artist since I was 6 years old.
Oh, nice.
I still, I'm not allowed to compete anymore, I still train. So I would love to jump into an action film, something I grew up on DC and Marvel. Like, whoever want to hire me, hire you. I think it just would be fun.
Would
be great fun.
And then we ask this to all our guests. Is there an underrepresented voice in the industry, whether it's an actor, writer, creator, storyteller, who's not in the mainstream that you want to give a shout out to or give shine to?
You said not in the mainstream.
Yeah.
Or like, you know,
maybe like they're like in the like
they're in that kind of limbo state.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, they're known within circles, but not by the masses.
Known within circles.
Yeah.
Ah, the two names that kind of pop up to me are already known by the masses. So I mean, look, right now I'd say I think that these two young ladies are doing justice to their platform the best way possible. Yara Shahidi and Storm Reid.
Yes.
Now, granted, they said, everybody know them. But
a lot of people don't surprise.
You'd be surprised.
Yeah. Well, I think they're just, shout to their parents because they did brilliant jobs. They are really using their platform to really speak out on the right subjects, the right ways. I think it's very commendable, respectable how they hold themselves. And I think they're truly great examples of what young women need to see as a representation coming out.
Yes.
I agree.
I love young men too.
Yeah. No, I'm happy like what this next generation sort of have been doing with their platforms. Like, granted, I know it's different from ours. Like, it's been really like inspiring.
You look at like something like Freeform and what they're doing. Granted, that's not my demo.
But still.
But I watch stuff on there.
Exactly.
And I'm like, oh, I'm so old. I don't care this.
I mean, I have little like cousins and nieces and nephews, and I'm like, I'm glad that because they like, love the,
Yara and, yeah, and they're seeing all these images of people of color and the queer community like as a normal thing,
right?
Which is like something. I mean, I know my generation.
So,
but all this.
I mean, still a fight. We got to fight. But
we here.
You know what I'm saying?
Aldis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you
this
both
was
for
great.
Your
clear eyes, full
hearts. Can't lose.
What is wrong with you?
I'm telling you.
What is wrong
not
with you?
Not getting my around
it. It's my jam.
No, Friday Night Lights was like that show was canceled too soon. Underground was canceled too soon. I was so pissed. Like that hurt. And I've never really felt like shows like come and go, but that one like really got to me.
Underground. We still don't understand why. I know why.
Well, we all know. We understand why.
We understand how this stuff
it's
is.
It's so funny. Exactly. I actually just met Mike Jackson.
Oh,
I had lunch with him and we were talking about it and I was like, I really wish that show found a new home because that was my show.
I mean, hey, they want to.
Well, you know what? If you guys are listening, if you want to revive Underground, Quibi, you got that? Quibi, y'all listening?
Quibi is taking everything.
HBO Max.
Quibi, honestly.
So many houses.
So many. Everybody got a stream.
No, but Quibi is like they're on something right now. Are we still recording? We're not recording. I thought we were done.
No, but yeah,
Quibi, do your thing.
Quick bites of Underground.
Right.
Exactly.
Let's do it.
But anyways, Aldis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.